There are many different ways of engaging in Buddhist practice and in Buddhist meditation practice. And I suspect that in different phases of a person's life and person's practice, there's a lot of different kinds of practices which are relevant. And that it's probably best not to have a one-shoe-fits-all kind of approach, but rather to be adaptable and flexible and to know different times, different kind of approaches to how we practice. And so some of the Buddhist practices can be quite elaborate. Some of them can be very simple. And what's been on my mind a lot lately is the simple side of Buddhist practice, the simplicity of it. Those practices which are very simple. And I want to talk a little about simplicity of practice, keeping the practice very simple, and how powerful that can be. One of the most simple instructions that I know for Buddhist practice, which also is simple and also very pleasant to hear, I think, is set yourself at ease and then notice whatever takes you away from that. That's all. That's it. Set yourself at ease and then notice whatever takes you away from that. And it doesn't mean that when you set yourself at ease that you can do a fantastic job at it, but just do it a little bit more ease than you normally would have. Be at ease with your difficulties, be at ease with whatever's happening in the moment, just some sense of ease with what's happening in the moment. And then sooner or later, chances are that it's sooner for most people, you'll lose that ease. You'll slip away from it. You'll get caught by something. That contraction, you lose that ease or you lose touch with it because the mind has drifted off in its thoughts. And then the instructions is notice what that is that's taken you away from your ease. Either wiped it away or just camouflaged it, hidden it from you because you're just distracted from it. Notice what that is. There's nothing in the instructions about criticizing what's happening. Nothing in the instructions about trying to do anything more, about trying to get back to your ease. It just says, set yourself at ease and notice what takes you away from it. There's something about the noticing, which is very profound, very powerful. And also noticing is very simple. So one of the things we'll notice is when we're not noticing. So it's one thing to, you know, we set ourselves at ease and then we notice what takes us away from it. And then we try to notice that, try to get familiar with that, to really see it really well. And the mind will drift off again or get caught up in something else or get more agitated or do something. Sooner or later, the mind gets into trouble. Have you noticed that? Sooner or later, the mind gets into trouble. And some people's minds are in trouble all the time. Preoccupied by things, or very critical, or harsh, or upset about something. Kind of, the mind's in trouble already with a certain kind of attitude. We bring an attitude of, you know, we're already in trouble, we're already somehow or other contracted or afraid or angry or annoyed or depressed or something. So the mind has a tendency of getting into trouble, getting into suffering. An even simpler instruction for meditation is the instructions. You drop the part about the ease and just notice what's happening. Forget about establishing ease. That's already maybe too complicated. You know, it's hard to remember. So make it even simpler and say, just notice what's going on. And if you do that, you'll notice that sooner or later you stop noticing. You stop paying attention. And that is a very important place to look at. Start paying attention to why you're not paying attention to what's going on here. Just paying attention is very, very simple. However, the mind wants to get in trouble. Or the mind wants to get into things, engaged in things. It often wants to do many other things besides paying attention. Now, if you have an elaborate meditation practice that's very, very elaborate and involved, and it can be very satisfying for the goal-oriented activity of the mind. It can be very satisfying for the mind that feels like it wants to control things and know what it wants, knows what it's doing, knows where it's going. Wants security, wants, you know, all kinds of things. So sometimes people find a lot of solace in complicated practices. Sometimes people are really put off by simple practices. Practices that offer you none of that. It doesn't even offer you hope. It doesn't offer you anything. It just says, pay attention. Notice what's happening now. Keep it really simple. How simple can you be? The value of simplicity, part of the value of simplicity in practice, is it can highlight very dramatically the ways in which the mind wants to make things more complicated than the things need to be. The simpler your practice, in some ways, the more radically challenging it is to the mind. Initially, it might seem great. This is easy. But after a while, you'll start doubting it. Or after a while, you'll start thinking about, oh, maybe I should do something else. Maybe I need to do that. Or I would really like this instead. Or this is boring. You know, nothing's happening. I'm just sitting here. You know, what's supposed to happen next? I saw a cartoon once of these two Zen monks, a young one and an old one. Someone's wizened old monk has been in the monastery for 50 years or something. And the young one turns to the old one and says, what happens next? Nothing happens next. What do you mean? I dropped out of college, I gave up a lucrative career and all these great things you can do with your life, and you're telling me nothing happens next? I mean, my friends, they're all doing great productive things with their lives, and nothing happens here? It's an outrage for the mind that wants to have and do and attain and have security. But part of the value of not doing, of being very simple, is it highlights better than almost anything else the tendencies of the mind to want and desire and get and avert, push away, resist. All this activity of the mind. And some activity of the mind is really beautiful. And some activities of the mind, like great creativity and feeling great, warm, loving feelings and compassion for your friends, and it's all kinds of wonderful things to be had. But sometimes those are very seductive because you can easily come to rationale of why you should be engaged in those things. It's so important. But some things are patently absurd that the mind does. And you can kind of, you could see it well. That why am I doing that again? This is ridiculous. As it's, someone once said, self-knowledge is seldom good news. Apparently that struck a chord. So to have nothing going on, or have a very simple thing, like just pay attention. After a while, the mind gets kind of nervous. And it starts trying to, its old habits creep in. And you get to see really well the tendency of the mind to do anything but stay simple, to stay doing nothing at all. And then what you can do is start questioning that. Is that really necessary? Do you really need to let the mind push you around? Do you really need to chase all the thoughts and ideas and motivations that go on? Do you have to pick everything up? Is it to your best interest to pick all the activities of the mind up? If you start noticing what's going on when you pick up things with the mind, you'll probably notice that a good percentage of the time, it hurts. If it doesn't hurt immediately, it hurts after a while. Even people who go in fantasy land, where the fantasies are really pleasant, and it's so satisfying, you can make this great big, you know, wonderful stories of being princesses and princes, and everything's happily ever after, and it's just great what the mind can do. But to live in that kind of fantasy world is very, very alienating, and it causes its own great difficulties to live there too long. So even being caught up in really pleasant things causes suffering or pain, sometimes in the long term, not in the immediate present. And then at some point, your mind might question, why am I not doing anything? Why am I just doing this very simple thing, noticing what's happening, staying in the present moment, staying in the present moment, not trying to accomplish anything, write the great American novel, or try to, you know, just try to solve all my problems, try to just stay here and very simple in the present moment. Why am I doing that? What's the value of that? One response is boredom. Another response is doubt. Another response is anger. All kinds of responses. Why am I doing this? Why? What is available right now that is liberating? What is available right now, here in this room, right here with you, sitting here in your chair with your butt in the chair or the floor, you know, with your eyes looking at me or whatever you're looking, or your thoughts thinking whatever you're thinking, what's he talking about? You know, what's happening right now that is somehow liberating or satisfying or alive? Or because part of what Buddhism points to is that right here, right now, there's a way of tuning in or settling in to something that's already here, that's present, that is liberating or of the nature of being liberated. Or that is, there's many different ways in which Buddhists talk about it. But something which is, one way is sometimes talk about something that's very still, or something which is at peace. Some dimension of the consciousness, some dimension of the psyche, which is at peace right here, right now. So the mind tends to get into activity. The mind has a very strong tendency to want to get into activity. Thinking about things. Forming attitudes about things, or creating feelings and emotions. These are all activities of the mind, activities of the heart. There is a dimension of the mind, an aspect of the mind, which is not an activity. And that non-activity aspect of the mind is always at peace with itself, at ease. So part of what we're trying to do, what's one of the possibilities in meditation practice, is to begin questioning all the activities of the mind as something that's interesting to chase after, and begin letting go of staying involved or chasing after, getting caught up in all the activities of the mind. So just stop getting involved in thoughts. You don't have to stop thinking. Thoughts can just pass through. But we stop getting involved in them. Emotions and feelings arise. We stop getting involved with them. They just arise. Impulses and attitudes and sensations and all kinds of things can arise. But there's no tendency to get involved in them, engaged in them, or to react against them, push them away or hold on to them, or use them to as a self-reference. This says something about me. So one of the things, to take things personally is an activity of the mind. It's not inherent in reality that we have to take things personally. Every thought you have doesn't have to be tied to your self-concept or to being a self. It can just be a thought that passes through. Taking things personally is an activity of the mind. We've got entangled, we've got engaged. What happens when we start letting go of all the activities? And one of the ways to do that is to be committed to one activity, a very simple one, in the midst of all the activities, which borders on not being an activity at all, that phases into kind of non-activity, and that is noticing what's happening. And limiting oneself to simply noticing what is happening right now, what's happening right now, what's happening right now. Not to notice what's happening right now and then say, that was really great now. I can't wait to tell my friends about this. Let me think, who should I call? Let me check I talked to that person yesterday. I think I'll talk to somebody else and call them up and tell them what a great now. And this is how I'm going to tell them about this great now that I had. When did I have it? And how many nows did I miss? Planning to tell them about that wonderful little fraction of a now that I had 5 minutes ago. Or we have some other now which is not so nice. And then we react to it and say, well, that's terrible. I can't stand it. And then we get caught up in that and react to that. But to simply stay in that moment, in that knowing, just knowing, and stay in the next knowing and the next knowing and the knowing, and trust what arises in the knowing. With time, as you do the noticing practice of mindfulness, you'll see all the different tendencies to do everything else but to know. All the things that the mind wants to do except know what's happening. The other thing is you'll start to learn to let go of those things and not get engaged in them. The other thing that will happen over time is we begin appreciating what it's like just to know. Or you start appreciating what it's like not to do anything. It's really one of the remarkable things that when the activities of the mind come to rest, what is left is deeply, deeply satisfying. So all the fear that the mind has that it needs, you know, that it needs to kind of fulfill and do and accomplish and get, is kind of deceptive. There is the aspect of the psyche where it can be deeply at peace with itself without needing anything more to happen. And it's very closely related to noticing, to awareness. As awareness gets stronger, as the tendency to be ability to notice gets stronger, it's said to become like a mirror. And a mirror is something which reflects what comes in front of it, but doesn't comment or react to what's in front of it. You put a really ugly object in front of a mirror, the mirror just reflects what's there. You put a beautiful object, the mirror just reflects what's there. You take a broken object, it just reflects. You know, whatever's there, it just reflects. When the mind gets more and more peaceful, Buddhists sometimes say more and more awake, it sometimes has the quality of just a mirror that just sees what's in front of it or what arises in it. In that same kind of equanimous way in which a mirror sees our experience. But in order to have that mirror-like experience, there has to be letting go of so much activity that we often cherish and love and hold on to and think, this is really, you know, this is who I am, this is what I need, this is what has to happen, my self-identity, so many of my wishes and desires, so many of the assumptions, so many beliefs. To really be able to be simple with a mind is probably one of the most radically challenging things a human being can do in their life. To simply set yourself at ease and notice what takes you away. Or simply do nothing else except to notice what's happening. Just do that. Just notice what's going on. Notice what's going on. It pulls the rug, eventually it'll pull the rug under, or it'll flush out some of the deepest cornerstones of what holds up our normal sense of self. And the mind can get very nervous when you get down to those cornerstones. I don't want to stop that activity. I didn't even know that was an activity. That's not an activity. That's, you know, like bedrock. He's telling me it's an activity and it's just a bedrock. All activities are activities. What about that part of the mind, the psyche, that's not an activity? In Zen, they sometimes call it the one who's not busy. I find it very fascinating, the process of going on meditation retreats, because there's so many different aspects of the psyche that are hard to notice until you do some kind of sustained spiritual practice, like what can happen on a retreat. And for example, one of the things I learned early on in my practice was I had all kinds of attitudes and activities, attitudes, understandings about what I was doing when I was practicing meditation. And when I sat and meditated 40 minutes every morning, those attitudes, those assumptions, those beliefs, those things I was trying to do, basically were just fine. They didn't cause any problems. I was so agitated to begin with that I was trying to get concentrated. Well, when you're as agitated as I was, it's pretty easy to get, you know, a teeny bit more concentrated. You just feel like you're calming down just a teeny bit. So I thought, oh, this is great. But then I would go on retreat. And what I found was that I was infusing my noticing practice with all these agendas, subtle agendas, that weren't revealed to me in my daily sitting because I wasn't sitting long enough. But when I tried sitting the whole day for days at a time, after a while, the rough edges, the dead ends, the troublesome ways in which I was engaging in meditation practice would reveal itself. It's like if you have a pebble in your shoe, you could walk maybe, you know, down the block and hardly even notice the pebble's there. But if you walk, you know, 10 miles, then the pebble really, after a while, you know, feels like a boulder. So the same things, the small things in the mind, which in daily life don't seem to be a big issue, big irritant, on retreat can stand out really clearly. Wow, I didn't know I was doing this. And so retreat sometimes is a way of coming, of going deeper and deeper into the stillness or the silence of the mind which is not active. Learning to question some of the most deepest activities that the mind has, that we think have to be there, but actually they don't. So this whole process that I'm talking about here today is a process of learning to let go of what is not necessary in the mind. Let go of all that's not necessary so that we can find the bounty, the happiness, the joy, the delight that comes in the simplicity of the mind, the radical simplicity of the mind, complete simplicity of the mind. If you're bored, that's an activity of the mind. If you stop that activity, what happens to the boredom? Boredom is not inherent in any situation at all. Boredom is a response, a reaction. If you question that and let go of that, where do you find yourself then? So to be simple. So a simple practice is sometimes the most powerful. And one of the things I like about simple practices is that they kind of resonate with the simplicity of being, which the practice points to in the first place. So I'd encourage you, maybe, if all of you, to try for a little while doing less in your practice. Do as little as possible, except notice what's going on and see if you can discover how little you can get, how little you can get away with. And so those are my thoughts for today. We have some time if you have any comments or questions.
I was sitting here and getting more and more furious as I'm listening to you. In science, they say, science or mathematics. The simple theory is the most general theory and is the most elegant theory. And you need years of practice to figure out how to use the Occam's razor to your hypothesis. And similarly, I think the practice that you suggest is a simple one is just an incredibly difficult. Just incredibly mind-bogglingly difficult. At least I have found that to be, because as you mentioned, unless you have the luxury of going on long retreats, even your noticing is so full of judgment. You are sort of prepping yourself to notice certain things and almost making them change. It's such quickly that noticing becomes wanting. The wanting becomes attachment, and you say, oops, attachment, come back. The reason I was got furious is I felt you sort of belittle the other practices. You say, you can do all these other practices that are engage your mind and the mind likes and But some of these practices, for say visualization practices from Tibetan, which is not something we do, but I found just incredibly wonderful. And sort of the other side of the same coin is here you are trying to look at all that changes and all that's busy and then figure out, take out what's busy and then what you're left is what's not busy. But it is so hard sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes. It's good to look at the other side and visualize. As one of the visualizations I've done is imagine that you are the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And the mind has certain amount of imagination of what that is, even my mind. Mm-hmm. And it just brings just that peace. It just brings that peace. And you notice what's not peace. You say, that's not the Buddha, and this is the Buddha, and that's not the Buddha. And I couldn't live with just this practice. I mean, it's just with suffering. Unless I went to a retreat and then there was enough silence and enough peace and enough support around me. In the daily life, this is just, it's horrible sometimes. You know? So why not take a little bit of peace? Why not use some of the other practices? What's wrong with?
Well, I started off the talk by saying that there's a time and place for all the different practices in Buddhism. And I think one shoe fits them all is not a very healthy way of thinking about Buddhist practice. So I think there's definitely a time and a place for visualization and for all kinds of things. And it's really beautiful and delightful to practice other things. Other more elaborate practices are, sometimes beautiful expressions of human capacity, natural human capacity and human development. And I celebrate all kinds of things which are much more elaborate than the simple practice I'm pointing to today. So, all in its own time. And some people find it very helpful to do something radically simple at the beginning of their practice. And some people find it's something you want to wait, 30, 40, 50 years before they get around to doing it. But sooner or later, there's a time and place for all of them. And it's always a little bit dangerous to teach anything because every individual person needs to be respected from where they are and their development, what's useful for them. And so I apologize that any of you were furious here. I know that when I started my Buddhist practice as a Zen student, that's the only practice I could do was a simple practice of Zen. It's kind of similar to what I talked about today. And, the kind of instructions I give now when I do the introductory course, I couldn't have practiced like that in my first years of practice because it was too elaborate, it was too complicated. Zen was just right for me. And then later, I was ready to hear Vipassana instructions and found that was really useful for me and really helpful and very profound. But I think it's valuable to know about this side of practice that I'm pointing to today, so that if you do pick up other practices, more elaborate practices, you can do it in a wiser way, and to understand and to do it for the right reasons, rather than to do it because you're holding on to security or the right practice or there's some complex thing that offers a lot of hope, and there's a lot of funny ways. I'm not critical of any practices, but I'm certainly critical of the way some people can do certain practices. And so, to get a sense of different possible ways of practicing, sometimes can help us kind of be clear, help us be clear why we're doing what we're doing and how we're engaging it, and so we can make it more useful for us rather than something that perpetuates our old habits and our old neurosis. And then at the beginning of what you said, Smita, what would happen to you if you assumed that what I was talking about was really easy? Take it for 24 hours, just assume it's really easy, and jump in.
Could you speak more about boredom?
Boredom. Well, boredom is an activity of the mind. So it's not boredom is not, as I said, it's not inherent in any situation. It's something the mind adds to the situation. And the tendency with boredom is to assume that the situation is boring. But the situations are never boring. It has to do with the evaluation and the attitude and the thing that the mind does to the situation. So it's an addition. And there's various theories various reasons why boredom might arise. Reason is that boredom is a subtle form of aversion or resistance. That I don't want this. I don't want to pay attention to this. I don't want this to happen. So we have some judgment about something. We're kind of pushing it away. Boredom is also a symptom of keeping things at a distance. Kind of follows a little bit on the first one. I don't want to get too close. I just hold things at a distance. And so boredom holds it at a distance. because it's somehow frightening or threatening to get really intimate, really close to what the experience is. And so one of the things to do with aversion, to boredom, is to look at, try to see how it's functioning, how it functions to keep us apart from what's going on. Another aspect of boredom is that boredom sometimes arises when we don't feel that whatever's happening or the person we're talking to, whatever, has any relationship to our egotistical self. When it supports our egotistical self, you know, someone praises us, well, great, you know, wake up then, thank you. It's really, this Buddhist wakefulness is great. I was awake for that. So, you know, praise kind of energizes people. But the opposite also can energize people. When we feel criticized by someone or put down, you can get really aroused and awake. And you go, okay, I gotta do. But if a situation or a person is neither inflating or deflating to our ego, then the situation or the person is just boring. You know, people get bored with that because it serves no purpose. So there's kind of the greedy side or the egotistical kind of wanting to make things happen or fix things or build up a sense of self. When something doesn't serve it, the response is, let's push this away. I don't need to deal with this. I don't want to be involved with this. Let's go talk to someone else who's more interesting because I'll get something from that person. So those are some of the different aspects of boredom that I could think of in response. Is that interesting? Sometimes boredom arises because we're more interested in our own thoughts than we are in someone else. Yes?
Simple take on that. When I was working with kids and they would say, oh, this is boring. And I would say, how could you unboard yourself? Or can you think of anything to do? Or how could you make a difference when you could just unboard yourself?
Unboard yourself. Yes.
I guess I think of boredom as the absence of interest. So your idea of boredom being an activity in and of itself, as opposed to the absence of an activity,
right,
is interesting to me.
Yeah.
I used to have a very regular meditation practice. This is the first time I've sat in probably a year and a half. I don't remember boredom being a huge part of my practice, but I was acutely aware of it this evening.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the ways to approach it is to study it, to notice it, get to know it really well, and notice all the different facets of it. Notice what it feels like physically. Notice what it feels like mentally. Notice what part of your body seems to get energized when there's boredom. Notice what goes on in the mind or the heart. Notice the beliefs and the thoughts that are connected to it. Just notice the whole ecology around it and study it. You know, maybe take a few weeks and study it when it arises. And there's a lot of value in getting to know something really well. So generally, I discourage people from letting go of things too quickly. Hang in there with something for a while until you know it really well. And then when you let go of it, it might let go of itself when you know it well. But then if you do let go of it, then you let go of it wisely because you really understood it. So I would encourage you to do that. And sometimes in studying something, sometimes you have to study not directly it, but rather some of the other things going on. So if you haven't meditated for a year and a half, and you sit down here and you get bored, it might be that you have such strong habits of how your mind's been operating over the last days or weeks or the last year and a half, that those there's so much momentum. And it's hard to shift gears from that momentum. And so that tension of, the momentum is still there, and something else seems kind of plain or boring or doesn't really speak to that momentum where the mind has been going. And so it takes a while sometimes to shift gears and be able to let go or unwind some of the momentum that's built up. Yes?
You talked about reflecting like a mirror.
I'm sorry, what could you say?
You talked about reflecting like a mirror and not getting caught up in what you're seeing. So I was wondering, could you use your dreams that you have as another tool of serving as a reflection of, or as a noticing of where you are as well.
Oh yeah, I think so. I'm not someone who knows a lot about dreams, but there are times when dreams very clearly seem to reflect something going on in our life, something that needs addressing and looking at. One of the ways we could work with dreams in our particular Vipassana tradition, when we use the practice with it, is wake up from a very strong dream. And rather than going into the content of the dream and analyzing it, sit up in your bed and tune into what the feeling is that's connected to the dream. And then sit with the feeling. Go into the feeling and meditate it. And that feeling will probably take you someplace significant. It'll help you work through something. There was next to you here. Claire.
Well, I just wanted to say a thought that I had in connection to what she said about boredom when you try to come back into meditation after having not done it a while. I've found during periods, and you know, every now and then I'll have a period of time where I fail to make the time to meditate. I feel I'm too busy, that I'm traveling, or just I have so much to do that I let it go. And if I go too long without that, it's very hard to get back in. And then when I try, at first it seems boring because I've kind of lost the knack of doing it. And you have to give it some time. I think it is hard to get back in if you have a period where you don't do it.
You can't just
pop back in.
Yes, I think very much so. Well, it's 9 o'clock, a little after nine. If we continue any more, more of you will get bored. So I hope it's been useful. And for those of you who've been furious today, I hope that fury has been useful too, to have it happen. And if it hasn't, it's not useful, then I apologize. And please leave whatever you heard here. Leave it here when you leave. Don't take it with you. Thank you.